Yep, Alpine. It's almost as far as Ramona, but. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom Navarez.
Hi, Tom.
My sobriety date is January 3rd of 1989. And I got a sponsor, and he's got a sponsor, and I sponsor a couple guys. I think that's what we're supposed to do. And I am talking tonight, and this is my least favorite form of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks, John. And no, it's always an honor and privilege, but you know, we gotta. I was taught that, you know, I didn't like being a GSR. I didn't like being a cleanup guy. I didn't like being a cop. I was taught that you got to take your turn. You don't only do the commitments you like. You take your turn doing everything. And I learned a lot by doing that. And what I've learned over the years is that this is my least favorite form of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, old guy Ted Howell was, hey, how you doing? Old guy Ted Howell was my mentor for years. And he used to, he taught us to say that I'm an alcoholic first. He says, who you think you are is going to change, but you will always be an alcoholic. And so I think that, you know, the first, I came in here thinking that I was the only one that felt like I felt. Like I was the only one that hated myself as much as I did. Like I was the only one that was ashamed of myself as I was. And I'm a guy who bounced in and out of here for 5 years. I got 3 502s in 11 months. And I'm not going to be one of these speakers that's going to tell you about all the time I didn't do, you know. You hear guys, I could have done 150 years, but I only did 6 months. You know, who cares? So anyway, I started coming to AA because I didn't want to go to prison. And I wanted to get out of trouble. And that was in 1984. And I didn't get sober till 89. So I always come into AA on Mondays with, you know, armful of holes, a hellacious hangover, spent the rent, forgot to see my kid. Wow. And I am very conscious of the repercussions of what happens when I drink. And then it goes tick, 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 tick. And the pain gets farther away. And that might be by noon on Monday, it might be 2 weeks later. But at some point, a beer sounds like a good idea. It wasn't that bad, you know. I like the idea, the definition of an obsession is an idea that overrides all other ideas and makes me believe a lie. That's the obsession, right? You know, and I tried all that stuff it talks about in More About Alcoholism. You know, I'll just drink beer. I'll just drink wine and listen to jazz, you know. I'll only drink outside the United States, you know. I'll only shoot heroin, you know. I'll only do that. And what I'm trying to do is make the truth not true. And the truth is that I'm powerless over alcohol. But I didn't know that, you know. We would laugh about being alcoholics. We'd sit in a silver spigot and laugh, say, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, me too, I'll buy this round, you know. But something very different happened on January 2nd of 1989. It was a Monday. And that run had started on Christmas Eve of 88. And I was up for 9 days, didn't sleep, didn't eat, smoke, 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 slam, 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 drink, drink, drink. And my friend Bill Cleveland calls that partying menage a uno. And he talks about, you know, flipping back and forth, you know. After about day 3 of a self-inflicted hostage taking like that, you know, You can hear conversations in airplanes flying overhead. You know, you can read a newspaper on the ceiling that isn't there, you know. And he talks about flipping between religious television and porn. And that's confusing. So, I mean, you know, I had been up for 9 days before. And I had had runs like that before. And I lived on this little teeny apartment on Marina Boulevard, and my ex-wife did something really chicken shit. She moved across the street from me. And I didn't see my son that Christmas. That run started on Christmas Eve, and once I get going, man, there's no stopping it. There is no stopping it. So between 84 and 89, I could never get 30 days. And there was a lot of times that I came into AA wanting to get sober. There was times I came because I didn't want to go to jail. But there was a lot of times where I really wanted to get sober. And I forget. Another way to say that is I become unconscious. I think that the process of our steps is really all about six different words, but they really mean two things. I think that consciousness and truth and sanity are all the same thing. And I think that unconsciousness and a lie and insanity are all the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I think the process of the steps lets me see the truth. And that's painful. And there better be a God or I'm screwed, you know. Right. And I think that the byproduct of living in the truth is freedom. And that's all I ever really wanted. Freedom from the bondage of self. Man, when you're on day 8 and you had a party pack of 100 syringes that were sharp and now you're sharpening them on a matchbooks and pushing a cutoff plunger in with your teeth and drinking what's left of beers that had cigarette butts in. I am just, you're down to the end, you know? Yeah. And I hate myself and I can't stop it. I can't stop, you know? And I label myself a coward. When I'm really partying, I tell you about hearing things and audible hallucinations, but I also see shit. And I see things growing underneath my skin and they gotta come out. So when I'm really partying, I look like a pepperoni pizza, you know? And so on day 9 of that run, you don't sleep. I lay on my bed and vibrate. And I couldn't put my foot on the floor even to go to the bathroom because there was this huge-ass rat in the corner of my room. And if I put my foot down, it was going to get me. And as the sun came up, I saw it was a pair of socks rolled up in the corner. So in the third step, you know what's funny? The third speaker I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous told that story. He was living in his sister's garage, and he was held hostage by a pair of socks. And I'm like, holy shit. So I think that's the job of a speaker, is to have people identify, you know? You know? When somebody gets up and everything's bitching and blah, 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 I sit there and go, wow, I do that stuff. What's wrong with me? And the bottom line is they're lying. So I think that identification and telling the truth is so much more important than sounding good. You know, you hear, I see some people in younger sobriety that act like it's an audition for a part in a movie, you know, and it's not. This is about telling the truth. And hey, I shit my pants too. You're not alone. You know what I mean? And that's the bottom line, man. I've done, you know, for instance, hearing that guy, my third speaker I ever heard talk about, I was never going to tell anybody about that. So the third step, says, take away my difficulties. That prayer says, take away my difficulties. I didn't know what my difficulties were. I thought my difficulty was the her of the day, the boss, the IRS, they were really bad. And, you know, I thought all that stuff was my difficulties. But those are circumstances in my life that I still have today. I still have those circumstances in my life. But before I knew the truth, they looked like difficulties. My difficulty is the perception of the circumstances in my life. And I can't see the truth. I probably could, but it's too painful. And it hurts too bad to look at what I've turned into, you know? And when I came in, I would hear people talk about alcohol quit working. And I'm like, what does that mean? What does that mean? I could drink right now and get drunk. But that's the difference between somebody who's an alcoholic someone who's an alcoholic and somebody who's not. Somebody who's not an alcoholic, they get drunk, they fall down, they whatever. Alcohol does something to them. Alcohol does something for me. I could walk into this Silver Spigot and there would be a certain set of Harleys outside and I would go in with some hesitation. And feel less than and all this crap that we have. And after a few beers, those guys are lucky I'm there, you know? I go from a, you know, laborer to an engineering student. I mean, you know, I would go home, but she'll be there whenever I get home, you know? I would pay the rent, but my landlord is a pastor and he's got a lot of money. He doesn't need it right now. And I would see my kid, but I can see him next week. It changes my perception of the circumstances in my life. And when that quit working, when I was just, are you falling asleep? When I was just really that guy, because drinking gave me the illusion of not being that guy. Drinking gave me the illusion to justify being that guy. I would hate me and go to, they deserve it. How does that happen? More importantly, what happens when that stops happening? And you really just are that piece of shit. You know, alcohol had quit working years before I stopped drinking. And I've got my disease in a headlock going, come on. We're having fun. This is fun. Come on. Yeah. And the fun was over, man. But I'm lying to myself because it's a protection mechanism. The truth is I'm a pathetic drunk. Let me digress. So I grew up, I was born in L.A., that's not why I'm an alcoholic. My parents got divorced. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. I went to Catholic school. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. But in 1971, we moved to San Diego, to Claremont, and I got to go, almost, and I went from Catholic school, salt and pepper, corduroy pants, shiny shoes, and a tie to public school. I did the last 3 months of sixth grade at Toller Elementary School, and I'm pretty sure that's why I'm an alcoholic. I had arrived, you know. I'm this little 100-pound kid with, you know, bell bottoms and paisley shirts and got to grow my hair out, and Dad wasn't around beating the shit out of us anymore, and my mom worked nights. There was a lot of opportunity to turn into what I turned into. Not that it's anybody's fault. It's just that environment really accommodated that nicely, you know. So I'm 11. So the summer between 6th and 7th grade is when I believe I started drinking alcoholically. My friend Keith Drum, I steal a lot of shit from other speakers, and one of the things that Keith Drum says, he says, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but from the first drink I took, an alcoholic was born. And that makes a lot of sense to me, you know? That makes a lot of sense to me because it changed the way I felt. It changed my perception. And man, I needed that, even as a kid, you know? So I was in and out of juvenile hall a lot. I got in trouble in school a lot. And I was just doing, you know, I was burglarizing houses and stealing cars and motorcycles, and I used to say robbing liquor stores, but that's a stretch. Stealing booze out of a liquor store is not robbing a liquor store. So that's another thing. As you hear, there's from the podium, you know, there's the story you tell your mom when you want her to get you out of jail. There's the story you tell your bunkie so you can sound like a badass. And then there's the story you tell from the podium, because you want sponsees, you know. And it's all just ego bullshit. And it really is silly. And I'm at a place in my sobriety where I can see it. And I really see it in other people. But I thank God I see it in myself, you know. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. So by the time I'm 16... I got expelled from junior high for smashing this kid's head through a glass display case in the art room, and then I got expelled from 4 different high schools, and I'm 16. And I am a little asshole, you know, with a drinking and drug problem, you know. I started first time I smoked heroin, I was 13. I'm hitchhiking everywhere, and, you know. So at that time, it was called the proficiency test. So if you're less than 18, you take the proficiency test. After 18, you take the GED, right? So it was the equivalent of a diploma. So I took the proficiency test, and I got out of high school. And I started shoveling concrete for $2 an hour, cash. And I've been doing that for 50 years. Yeah, that means I'm old. So, but back then, I mean, you know, $2 cash was a lot of money because minimum wage was $1.75. You know, and you could buy a 5-finger lid for $10. You could buy a hit of acid for $2. You buy a rack of speed for $1, you know. You get a quart of Eastside for 55 cents and get a nickel back on the bottle. And we're making $16 a day. How much money do you need? You know? And I grew up in the trades. And I went union young. And I was just, you know. It's funny, because I remember when we moved to San Diego, in and out of juvenile hall, some stuff happened in there, and I hated blacks, and I hated cops. And after we moved down here, my mom married a 6'7" black cop. God's got a sense of humor, man. You know what I mean? And I'm not going to tell you what happened in juvenile hall, you know. It probably isn't real anyway, you know. It was my perception, you know. It's my perception of what happened. There's nothing against the Catholic Church. It's my perception of, you know. I never understood the plastic Jesus on the dashboard of the station wagon, the plaster of Paris Mary in the church, and the Stations of the Cross, and you go tell the priest in the little room what's going on, and you get absolved. I never understood any of that. And I never had an experience of any kind of comfort from a God from that church. Now I see people that get a lot of comfort from that, and I applaud that. But that was not my experience because of my perception. You know, they beat the shit out of me because I deserved it, you know. So anyway, I'm a serial marrier. I was, the first time I got married, I was 19, she was 18. And I'm in construction, I had just gone union. And doing some big stuff, and I took the prep course for the state surveyor's license, and you know, taking drawing classes, and I really, you know, I'm going, this is my chance. So the poor girl that I married was a cheerleader at San Diego State, and she had a union, she was a checker at Vons. But more importantly, her dad was vice president of the Carpenters Union. And he had a bunch of oil wells in Oklahoma. And he was the head of the engineering department of City of San Diego. And they were perfect for me.
Wow.
It's funny because he was my first amends. Wow. I felt worse about burning him than any of you, you know. He trusted me and I burned him, you know. So she was really straight. And I met her dad because we lived across the street from them, and we'd have a refrigerator box that we would fill up with Coors cans in 3 days. And I met her dad because one night we were drunk sitting on the sidewalk shooting out streetlights with a .22. And that's how I met her dad, and then I ended up marrying his daughter. Big mistake for all of them. So, she was super straight, and I would deck the bank account all the time. I would not come home. When I did come home, she'd smack me in the head with a frying pan, you know, and she was super. Then I ended up, you know, her and I got divorced, and she didn't want to get divorced because she knew there was some heart in there. I'm really jealous of those mugs. So anyway, they had $65. I don't know about that, but. So I'm, you know, I'm a drunk, and this is an AA meeting, but I'm a drunk with a needle fetish. I shoot anything, anytime, you know, and, my second wife. That marriage lasted for 2 years. We got divorced. I was 21. Got married again right away to a girl that was just like me.
Wow.
I thought the straight girl would fix me. Forget it. The fight's over. I'm going bad, you know?
Yeah.
And her and I had a kid right away. I'm not sure which came first. I think she was, she was pregnant when we got married, but. My son was, I was 22 when my son was born, 1983. And then I had moved out from her and moved in with my cocaine dealer and a week before my son's first birthday. And I'm not proud of any of this stuff. It's just my story. And hopefully somebody can identify and say, man, I felt like that, you know, and that's what this is for. So when I did come in, I'm bouncing all over the place, but when I did come in, I got abducted by these AA Nazis, and they made me go to 7 meetings a week and have commitments at all of them. And that's just the way it was, you know. And my first commitment was at Old Town Speakers meeting. I was 5 days sober, and I've had a commitment there for 37 years. And it don't. So, you know, you hear a lot of stupid stuff in AA. And one of them is the definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting a different reward. When I do that, I'm just dumb. The definition of insanity is finding something that works and then stop doing it. Why would I stop doing what works? That's insane. doing the same thing over and over again is just the same dumbass I've been all my life, you know? So I moved out from her. I had this job making more money than I ever lied about from a bar stool. And I got 3 502s in 11 months. And they were pretty pissed. So I started coming to AA. And like I said, in 5 years, I could never get 30 days. So after I saw it was a pair of socks, I got up and looked in the mirror, you know. And what's left of my fingernails, what's left of the skin on my face, I hadn't eaten for 9 days, you know. I got infantigo. Everywhere I can reach is a scab. This is a vision for you ladies. You too. So everywhere I can reach, my back, my face, underneath my hair, everywhere's a scab, man. And I had infantigo. You know, my body has zero nutrition besides the water and the cocaine. And I was just a walking infection, you know. And I got up, and what was different? This is what was different. It was a Monday morning, like hundreds of Monday mornings like that. And I have a pet peeve. When people take a cake and they say, if I can do it, you can do it, bullshit. I don't do it, and neither do you. We do it. We do it. There's a chunk of God in me, and there's a chunk of God in you. And when those pieces get together, they're more powerful than any of us alone. I don't do it. We do it. And so you know, I studied with these monks for years, and I've done all kinds of spiritual stuff, and I just really had to dummy all that down. Now, because I can be so arrogant that I'm more spiritual than you. What kind of horseshit is that? You know what I mean? It's kind of like me in relationships. I lead them to believe that I'm not giving them something. No, you're not. Come on, you got it. I know you got it. Give it to me. You know, I know you can do this. The truth is, I don't have it. But I let them think that I have it, you know? And I do the same thing in AA. I do the same thing in AA because of my ego. And it's such an easy thing to do. And I was talking to Kim before the meeting, and it's funny because how perception changes. Time and sobriety changes. How things look to me at 37 years, or they look the same thing, looked different when I was 5 years sober. The same thing looked different when I was 10 years sober. The same thing looked. So I think this is all about living in the truth. I think the process of our steps is simply living in the truth. And that's my definition of spirituality. Because when I'm living in the truth, I got nothing to hide. I was going to tell this. I usually tell this story at the end, but I'll get to it. But sorry for being a spaz. But I was a single dad. I ended up being a single dad with 4 kids in sobriety. And we would drive around. I had to find shit for them to do. You know, I mean, we go to the river, we go to the desert, we do all their sports, and they were on me. And my kids have been to more AA meetings than a lot of people I know in sobriety. And people would say the same stupid shit all the time, and they'd make up AA words. So everything's spiritual. It's so spiritual. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. So they'd make up AA words to mock us. And one of them was smiracle, because that's a spiritual miracle. And they they'd turn on the light switch and go, Smearcall. We really are pretty silly. It's an easy thing to do. So we're on 2nd Street, and I have a Ford truck that looks like a penis extension, 40-inch, big, we're desert people, And I'm in East County, so what do you do? And traffic is stopped. There's two lanes, and there's like a bike lane or whatever, and traffic's kind of stopped. And I'm looking in my rearview mirror, and there's an extremely large woman in a convertible Cadillac. And I was watching her in the mirror, and she'd pull up about every three cars, and she'd lean out and yell at the car next to him. So in these, we spent a lot of time in the truck. And we'd have a lot of talks about God. And this particular talk, we were talking about heaven and hell. And they said, do you believe in heaven and hell? And I said, I don't, what happens after I die? I couldn't care less. I think you do the right thing and you're good to people because it's the right thing to do. And I said, and they said, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? So what do you think? You don't believe in afterlife, but what do you think about heaven and hell? And this is a bad question to ask your kids in the same car that you're in. I said, have you ever lied or stolen something? They're like, yeah. And I go, you know how you're in your head? And it's, man, what's going to happen if I get caught? And I got to give it back, and then I got to apologize, and I don't want to get caught. And I go, when you're in your head like that, that's what I think hell is. And they said, well, what do you think heaven is? And I said, I think heaven is when you can do something for somebody else and it makes their day better. I think that's what heaven is. Hell is in your head and heaven's in your heart. I'm not a church guy, but that was my little spiel to them. And right then, that fat lady pulled up next to us, and she sticks her head out the side of the car. You could see the meat on her face shaking. Right? And my son Jake was sitting in the passenger seat, and he turns around and he goes, wow, that lady's really in hell. I usually close with that, so I'm going to sit down. So I had Michael. I'm drinking. I'm a mess. I'm dragging my disease around, pretending it's still fun. And something very different happened on that Monday with the pair of socks. And I get up and I look at myself in the mirror and I see what I turned into. And all of those other Mondays, it was, I need to stop this. Yeah. I need to quit. That's a lie, too. I can't do it. I can't do it any more today than I could 37 years ago. I need you. I owe you the truth. I owe you the best version of me. You don't always get it, but... We take turns being our best to each other. So I look at myself and there's a difference between crying and sobbing. I'm like sobbing and the tears are going through all the scabs on my face and it's blood, it's just disgusting. It's just gross, And what was different about that Monday morning is that the fight was over. Wow. Fuck it. I'm gonna die like this, and I don't care. I don't care. The fight's over. I can't do this. This is bigger. Alcohol is my master. Mm-hmm. That's called a surrender. Yeah. So there was a guy who's been my best friend since I was 13. He's still my best friend today. And, nobody trusted me anymore. Nobody trusted me. Couldn't have a tab at the bar. The drug dealers didn't trust me. I just became pathetic, I became a day concrete finisher because I couldn't have a real job, you know. And I surrendered. And I had heard that James had been sober for 6 months. I heard that in the bar, actually. And and I called him up. It was a Monday morning. It was Monday, January 2nd. And I said, man, I had, right before I called him, I lived in this little piece of shit apartment on Marina Boulevard. And I knelt down at this one little sunny spot. You know, it had to be 5:30, 6 in the morning, something. Next to my shitty little dining room table. And I just begged God, I said, please don't let me live like this anymore. I can't take it. You know? And I called James. So if you're 6 months sober, no offense, but he didn't know shit about Alcoholics Anonymous. But he knew that his life depended on trying to help me. And he gave me the most precious thing that any of us can give each other. He gave me his time. He took off work. And he came over and cleaned all the spoons and syringes and empties and ashtrays and the cigar box full of weed. I go, the weed? Are you serious? And helped me clean all that up. And I didn't see my son that Christmas who lived across the street. You can't wash that off, you know? I hated me. And I had bought him a train set. And James, we cleaned everything up, and he helped me mount this train set on a piece of plywood. And my son came over that day. Walked across the street. And all that he saw was his dad. All that I saw was a scab and a failure and a pathetic piece of shit. And I told him that I was sick. And that's why I didn't see him for Christmas. And I was too embarrassed of the way that I looked to go to a meeting that night. That was a Monday, so my sobriety date's January 3rd. And I went to a meeting on a Tuesday night, and it was a bunch of, I was 28. Michael, my oldest son, was 5 when I got sober. And they got me. You know, I swear, I did not go to that meeting that Tuesday night to stop drinking. I swear to God. I went to that meeting Tuesday night because I couldn't stand another second of myself. And I didn't know how else to live. And you showed me through action. Shake hands at the door. I do that at every meeting I go to. I didn't do it here tonight because I'm a speaker. But because that is the truth. I owe my life. I will always be in service and in debt to you. There's no amount of inconvenience. There's no amount of money. There's no amount of time. That's another thing. We need to speed up the singing in this group. Sucks. So anyway, it sounds less bad when you don't sing slow. So anyway, the first commitment I had was at Old Town. And that was a Sunday night. I got sober on Tuesday. Sunday night, I'm 5 days sober. They stood me at the door and got me in action. And I think that's what spiritual action is. That's living in the truth. I need to be of service to you. That's the truth. Shaking hands at the door, putting away chairs, making coffee, all the stuff I don't want to do, mopping floors at that time, cleaning ashtrays, watching coffee cups, is spiritual action because it's living in the truth. You know, you don't run out of a... You don't run out of a... The reason you run out of a burning building is because that's what you're supposed to do. You know, the reason I have commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous is because it's given me freedom. At the time, I just thought it was these bossy assholes that were making me do stuff I didn't want to do. But it saved my life. I didn't know it was spiritual action. They did. I'm 28, long hair, big old porn mustache. Back then I had a six-pack. I traded that in for a party ball now, but... I'm a young kid that didn't know how to live. And those commitments at every meeting I went to saved my life. The guy was talking about 90 days. I remember I had 90 days and I went to my sponsor. I said, I got 90 days. You think I can back off? He goes, yeah, absolutely. He goes, just back it off to one a day. Yeah. So, So I remember at 6 months, I have all these commitments. I got my son, and he's going to meetings with me and stuff. And I went to my sponsor. I said, I got 7 commitments, but I'm a responsible parent now. Do you think I could get rid of a couple of these? And he goes, why would you want to do that? You've never been sober 6 months in your life unless you were locked up. And I said, well, I'm not sure I want to put all my eggs in one basket. He goes, Tom, a guy like you only has one egg. And it better be the God that you found through the action you've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous. The God that I found through the action I've taken. How heavy is that, man? That is the truth, baby. That is the truth. And I still get to experience God through the action. Action, 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 action. The most spiritual thing I can do is live in the truth, right? So anyway, I had, in 88, it was like October of 88, I had brought this chick home from the spigot, and she stayed for a couple days until my dope was gone. And she was good looking, I didn't know her, but that's what we did in 88, was bring people home. It was a lot better world back then. And so she called me. I was 30 days sober. And she goes, hey, this is Robin. You remember me? I'm like, yeah, kind of. And she goes, well, I'd like to see you. And I said, I just got 30 days. I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not going to be any fun. And she said, well, I found the Lord. So she came over, and within 20 minutes, she had lost the Lord. Although there was talk of God. So, I'm getting a call 3 weeks later. I'm pregnant. You're the dad. I'm like, fuck you, Because by then I'm working, I thought she was daddy hunting, Yeah. That's because I have integrity and morals and scruples. Yeah. I am a dog, right? And I'm just learning how to live. I'm just learning how to write a goddamn check. Right. I got nothing for you except my commitments in AA. And they changed me like alcohol used to. They didn't change my perception, they changed my truth. Big difference. So living in the truth has changed my perceptions. Anyway, she has a kid in November of the first year. I get sober in January, she has a kid in November. I'm like, good luck with that, it's not mine, So I'm such a stand-up guy, after Hannah was a year old, I took a paternity test. Because my sponsor made me, not because I'm a good dude. And I found out she was mine. So I moved out of that apartment. I got a house up in Claremont and got a room set up for her and had a room set up for Michael, because I had years ago been in the import-export business, and my ex-wife had kind of taken that over once I got sober. And Michael was in a bad environment, So I went to go get Hannah. Let me back up. So after I found out Hannah was mine, me and Michael are driving down Morena Boulevard in my 65 Ford truck, and we have matching mullets, and he's got on a Scooby-Doo shirt with the sleeves cut off, you know. And I said, Michael, it looks like you got a sister, man. And I know how to be a dad to a boy. I mean, you look good dirty, you know. But I don't know how to be a dad to a girl. And I only got a couple minutes left. I don't want to cry through it. Jesus Christ. That's the thing. So he scooted over and he put his little arm around me and he goes, we can do it, Dad. And we did, you know. I went to go get Hannah on her second birthday. And I didn't know her mom, you know. And she was really going downhill. She was a mess. You know, crack and heroin, and the places she was living were gnarly. And I'm trying to avoid responsibility and turning a blind eye to it, yeah. You know, because I'm a pussy. And I went there on her second birthday, and she's got shit running out of her diaper. She had on a sweater that used to be white that was filthy. And there's no food, there's no toys, there's no furniture in her little shitty apartment. And it was her birthday. Mom's got tracks up and down her arms and can barely talk. But what she did tell me is that two guys came into her apartment the night before, and one of them took her in the bathroom and raped her, and she doesn't know what happened to Hannah. Wow. So I had to take her. I'm 2 years sober now, getting semi-conscious, barely. And I took her. You know, and I took her home. She didn't have anything. There was nothing to take. A couple diapers, maybe. I don't remember if there was that. And I took her home, and I gave her a bath. And I looked at her. You know, she didn't really know me. I'd taken her to the park a few times. She kind of sort of knew who I was. And I looked at her, and I didn't see anything, you know. And I gave her a bath, and her and Michael and I went to Mervyn's and bought a bunch of toys and clothes and stuff for her. And I had Hannah, you know. But spiritual giant that I am, I abuse those kids. Not by, like, beating them, but I don't know if you were ever a semi-good-looking dude with a puppy on the beach. They're like magnets. Can I come and do your laundry? Can I bring you dinner tonight? It's like, well, okay, you know. I abused the shit out of that, I'll tell you that. So after about a year of being a single dad, I'm like, man, I need a wife. And I got married again. I was 32, she was 23, which I think is a perfect proportion. And her and I had two kids back to back. And I was in a lot of debt from my prior life. And you pay the dope man first because the IRS doesn't kill you. And so I owed the IRS 120 grand. My balances, I got sober in 89. I hadn't paid taxes since 83, you know. And my balance is going up. I called them, made arrangements, you know. And my balance is going up. And my sponsor says, well, why don't you go get a contractor's license? Maybe you can make some more money and pay it off faster, you know. So I didn't go to school, but I borrowed a friend of mine's cassette tapes for Golden State Contractor School. Wow. And went and I got a contractor's license. And I put out an ad in the Penny Saver. I don't know if anybody remembers. It was that big. Concrete work and my phone number, right? $35. Which I thought was outrageous. And it was out for 2 days. And this lady called me and she goes, I did 385 houses last year and I fired my concrete guy this morning. Do you want to come and talk to us? Wow. So I did. And it was just crazy. A lot happened really fast. her and I had two kids 14 months apart. And, you know, I was so unconscious in that marriage that I thought I was really doing the right thing. And I'm building this empire for my family. I'm working 7 days a week, 80, 90 hours a week. And basically, I got this young, hot wife at home with four kids. Never, you know, she was overwhelmed. And I'm an asshole, sober asshole. But I'm so unconscious, I think I'm doing the right thing. And in hindsight, I was so pissed when we got divorced. So last year, she developed a little gambling habit, and she spent 90 grand in a casino last year we were married, and that's all I could see. But the truth is, I abandoned my young wife with four kids. That's the truth, you know? So when we were both 10 years sober, she started drinking again. We got divorced. You talk about the disease out in the parking lot doing push-ups while you're in a meeting. She went off. She's in jail all the time, cooking pounds and pounds of speed with these guys that I wouldn't have dealt with when I was getting loaded. And she was a mess. And I had to take the boys, too. I got them when they were 5 and 6, so I had four. And that's when I built that house in Alpine. I didn't want them growing up in the city. So when her and I got divorced, I had 35 guys. I'm doing millions of dollars worth of work. And I just focused on my kids. I went down to 7 guys. And I was saying no to between $200,000 and $500,000 worth of work a week. People say, why did you build all this up? And now I said, I can't live like that. There's things way more important than money. And it took me being 10 years sober and getting whacked in the head by life to be able to know that. I got whacked into consciousness, you know, because I was living a lie, thinking I was living the truth. And I was a GSR, I had commitments, I sponsored guys. So you can do that and be in action at the same time. I did it. There was a group that started in my living room 28 years ago. It's called the We Group. And it's 21 years old now, but it started in my living room 28 years ago. And, you know, I've done a lot of the right things in Alcoholics Anonymous for the wrong reasons. I've sponsored people for notoriety, you know. I've spoken places because I wanted to be a speaker. What a joke. I've done a lot of the right things in Alcoholics Anonymous for the wrong reasons. And it takes a minute to find that out. But I'm glad I know now, you know. So talking to Kim, I don't talk about bringing those kids up as a feather in my cap. I don't talk about taking care of my dad who had Alzheimer's for the last 9 years of his life. I never liked my dad till he got Alzheimer's. Then he was a lot of fun. And then my mom lived with me for 4.5 years, and I would see her every day that I was in town when she went to a place, you know. And I don't say that because Tom Navarez is a bitchin' guy. I say that to illustrate the change that God can bring about in a man's life. God did it. I didn't do it. So when someone says, get up here and tell us how you did it, say, I didn't do it. God did it. Yes. And it's all your fault. Thank you.
I would like to thank Tom, and I hope you come back soon to visit us, even though you don't like to speak. Let's give Tom another round of applause. I would also like to thank the Women's Auxiliary and the residents in the house for a fantastic dinner. It was really good. And we will now close in the usual manner with a prayer of Tom's choice.
Joyce, hold your hand.
Now, Mary, huh?